The following is a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
Welcome to Cartoon Fun. It's Cartoonerific. Yeah!
It's Cartoonerific.
Me, Brian Mitchell, and welcome to the Cartoonerific podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons. I am your host. Well, last week on the old podcast here, I was interviewed by Marjorie Stewart. She did a great job, and she's picking up today for part two. It's another long one. It's an hour and a half. So, sit tight, buckle in. It's a wild ride, folks. Before we get to that, I do want to point out there's been some interesting 2D animation lately, and of all places, you can find it on YouTube. Andrew Chesworth has the Brave Locomotive. You could check that out on YouTube. It's a wonderful, wonderful short, so please check that out. And then there is another short that is on. It's actually a number of shorts from James Lopez. The name of the title of the whole thing is Hullabaloo, and it was a crowdfunded project from a few years back. Well, anyway, he's making these available on YouTube. So the first episode is up and running, so check that out. It is Hullabaloo. They're both wonderful, wonderful shorts. They're about anywhere between, 5 to 10 minutes, so roundaboutly. You'll really enjoy them. If you really love 2D animation, please check them out. And coming up next is a wonderful interview with my favorite guest, myself. Sorry. No, it's Marjorie Stewart will be doing that interview, and we're going to pick that up in just a minute.
You're listening to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons, with your host animator, Brian Mitchell.
Hello, I'm Marjorie Stewart. I'm back again as your temporary Cartoonerific podcast hostess, filling in for Brian Mitchell. Why? Because I'm interviewing Brian Mitchell. If you missed it last week, we covered part one, which was wonderful. And if you haven't listened to it, please go back and listen. It's wonderful. It's about the development of a young animator. And now I am happy to present part two as the journey continues with Brian Mitchell. Please enjoy. Back to your first big real job, big break.
The big break happened. So this is what happened. I sent a portfolio out to Filmation Studios. I heard that they were working on these. They had a contract. They had some deal that they're going to be doing a bunch of feature films, and they're all going to be based off of fairy tales. And they were staffing up. They needed feature quality people to work on this stuff. I figured this is my way in.
Okay.
Right. So I sent out a portfolio to a gentleman. Actually, I called Filmation. They gave me this gentleman, and his name was George Sicara, who was... I ended up eventually meeting him years later, but I called him up and I said, I'm trying to break in. I said, I understand you got feature films that you're going to be doing and you're going to need people. And he said, oh yeah, yeah. No, we're working on the first one. We got another one coming, right after this. Yeah. And we're definitely looking. And so he gave me an address. So I FedExed him out a bunch of drawings, and he called me up the next day after he got them.
Wow.
And he said, yeah, everything looks good. I'd like to give you a test. And so tests, I always heard that tests are made for people to fail. I've always heard that because the test is basically, they make it normally so difficult that, you know, instead of giving us something easy that, you know, at least we can use the guy in production or the, you know, that person in production, they give you the most difficult thing. And then if you don't pass it, it's like, yeah, sorry, buddy, you know. Wow. But they gave me a test and I was like, okay. And so I did the test. I sweated through it. And it was two drawings. I had to do the breakdown drawing between. Uh-huh. So how that is, let's say if you have a character and he has his hand up like this.
Hailing a taxi.
But okay. Maybe he brings his arm down. Maybe there's a drawing in between that needs to be done to kind of flush that out. So anyway, breakdown drawing. Anyway, so I did the test and I sent it back. And surprisingly enough, they called me up and they said, yeah, your tests look a little bit rough around the edges, but he said, no, it looks pretty good. I think we can use you. And so they gave me an offer. And so I didn't even know what they were going to pay me. So I figured, well, it's education, right? Whatever. So I accepted the job. And so he said, well, do me a favor, call me back next week and we'll give you a start date. Between the week, that week,
yeah,
the division was shut down.
Oh, good Lord.
And they decided.
Sorry.
That's all right. So this was announced in the trades that they were basically not doing it. They were not going to, they were going to finish up the film that they had, which was a Pinocchio movie. They had already done a Snow White thing. And so I guess based off of the reaction, maybe, you know, the investors didn't want to go ahead with it. They shut it down. So they said, yeah, we're going to be doing it in-house. We're going to not hire any people. We're just going to use people that we have already to finish it.
So they rescinded.
I've had that happen a couple of times over the years, but the second time would be like a Disney thing that I was offered to come in-house and work on Mickey, Donald, and Goofy. Mm-hmm. That was years later. But anyway, he was very nice to me, and he said, look, this gentleman, Ralph Bakshi, has something he's working on, and he will take on young people, you know, as green, you know, green, you could be as green as long as you're talented, you know, I'll take you on. So this was a person I did not want to work for.
Oh.
And the reason why, he's a New Yorker. Ralph Bakshi is a New Yorker, talented gentleman, but he used to make these X and R rated animated films.
Oh boy, okay.
So Fritz the Cat, Coonskin, Heavy Traffic, these were all Ralph Bakshi movies.
Okay.
And so they were all, Fritz the Cat was an X rated movie. not hardcore X, but just, you know, but it was still, you know. So anyway, that was something that I decided early on, you know, back in the day when I was going to SVA, somebody said to me, he said, would you ever work for Ralph Bakshi? I said, no, never. I don't, you know, and so that was something that, you know, I just remember, yeah, I would never work for that guy. So all of a sudden now, you know, 6 years later, I'm sending out a portfolio to Ralph Bakshi. But he was working on a show, it was a revival of Mighty Mouse, the New Adventure, Mighty Mouse, the cartoon, but he was calling it Mighty Mouse New Adventures. Mm-hmm. And so they had a couple of things that they were planning on doing, but I called up the studio. I said, yeah, just send out your portfolio. It doesn't need to be anything big, you know, just, you know, some drawings, what you're doing. And, we'll call you if we need you, you know. And so I did the same thing there. I sent out maybe 10 drawings because it didn't seem like they were doing anything at the time. Mm-hmm. So I put it in a FedEx envelope, I sent it out, and then the next day, I get a phone call from Ralph Bakshi, the director of the studio.
For whom the producer, you would never work for. Ever.
And Ralph had a very Ralph kind of sounds like Sylvester the cat, you know, very with the Thufford Thuckatash. But it was very Brooklynese, right? And so he called me up and he said, "Your drawings are great. I love what you're doing." He thought, "I want to hire you." And so.
What you doing?
So I was very flattered, and so I wanted to know, like, well, when do you think that's going to happen? So, well, we got something going on. Yeah, I should know something in a week. Yeah, so anyway, so he said just check back every couple of weeks. So I did that. So a year later.
Oh my gosh. I feel like we should cue the strings, the saga.
Yeah.
This is a lot.
It was a lot. So basically a year later, I was calling every couple of weeks, but there was nothing going on. They had nothing going on. They were in development hell.
Wow.
Developing a lot of different things. And so finally... I want to say they had something that was very close the following year. And so once again, it was like, you got to call us because this could happen at any time.
Wow.
So it was like every couple of weeks and I went to every month or so. And now I was calling every couple of weeks again. And so there was still nothing going on. So another 9 months pass.
Wow.
And I don't know where I heard it from, but somebody said, yeah, you know, it looks like Ralph has that show going on, the Mighty Mouse show.
Right.
And it looks like he sold it. So I called up and they forgot all about me.
Wow.
So I was like, so the thing was like, well, send us your portfolio. So I don't think I deviated. I think I may have added a few things to it, but I pretty much sent him the same thing I had.
Yeah.
Because I knew that got his attention the first time. So I sent it. And once again, I got a phone call and I was working at the time. I think it was at a department store, just doing like a part-time thing.
Uh-huh.
And my father called me up and he goes, yeah, some guy named Ralph Bakshi called you. He wants to hire you. I excused myself. I said, I have to go home from work.
Yeah.
And so I went home and I called up and they put me right through to him. And he said, yeah. When can you be out here? Right.
Wow.
And we got this show. It's going to be on CBS, and so we're trying to put together a team. And your stuff is great. So at least the opinion didn't change, and you really didn't want to hire me.
Right.
So he said, "When can you be out here?" I said, "Monday."
So how did this moment feel? Now we've been through, my fellow listeners, we have been through a lot.
Yeah.
You know,
right?
A lot.
Yeah.
And now we want to hire you.
Yeah.
How did you feel?
Ecstatic.
Yay!
I just found it really weird because this was like the guy that I really didn't want to work for, but now I was just so happy to have a job with him.
Yeah, but that might have been a lesson.
I think it was.
Yeah.
I think it was.
It's very seems poignant to me.
Yeah. But it's like, that's a lesson for everybody. You know, it's really like, you know, you work for who you can work for, you know, and it was nice because, I grew up on that show and now we were doing a revival of
the Mighty Mouse.
And so, but what was funny, the show came from New York, but this would be done in Los Angeles in the Valley. And so, I was ecstatic, but then I started thinking about it. And I'm like, yeah, but what if I go out there and what if I fail? What if I, so those doubts came in, like, mm-hmm. what if this doesn't go well? You know, am I going to be crushed? You know, I mm-hmm. remember thinking this. I mean,
well, undoubtedly, like a sense of elation, you know, for anyone intelligent is going to be accompanied with some trepidation. I mean, it's you must have had such an extreme feeling after receiving that news that, you know, and given that you had been through so much to get to this point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I figured that, you know, I'm going to go, I'm going to do the best job I possibly could. So when I went out there, I basically got a ticket right away. I think I flew out there on a Sunday. And I stayed in some hotel in Studio City. Not a dive, nice hotel actually, but it, you know, but anyway, but I remember, okay, I know the studio was in this direction, but I didn't have a car. So it was like, I had to take public transportation up there. And so it wasn't like around the corner from where I was living.
Right.
It was, you know, it was a little bit, it was about 4 miles away. So it's a long ride on the bus, you know, because
mm-hmm.
you stop in every two blocks, you know, or three blocks.
Mm-hmm.
But I took the trip there because I wanted to see where it was. And so, yeah, I ended up finding it. And there were people there that day. They were working in the studio, so I kind of, you know, I came in and said hello, and so that was really neat. And one of the artists there, who a lot of people might recognize, John Chris Felucci, is Canadian. He was directing the show, and he was very nice to me. And he came out and he said, "Oh, we loved your drawings. Wow. We all loved your drawings." And so they're happy to have me. So John was very nice to me, but he got into some trouble years later. And I'll, you know, I think a lot of people know about that, but you know, my relationship with John was very, very good.
So, welcoming.
Welcoming and appreciative and continued to be so. And it was rough the first couple of days. Not going to sugarcoat it. It was rough the first couple of days when I actually was starting to do the job.
Oh, no doubt. It must have been a huge adjustment.
Well, it was so – because I not worked in a studio environment. And right. I was very, very green. And my drawings were very, very tight. And they want the drawings to be very fluid and loose. And they saw that in my portfolio. But when I was working on the first scene that they gave me,
yeah,
I really tightened up quite a bit, mm-hmm. and basically the drawings were not as fluid. I was called into Ralph Bakshi's office, and he had the thing that I worked on,
yeah,
and he was like, he said it's, you know, it's good, but he said you need to loosen up. He said to me, "Is there anything I can do for you to help, you know, to help?" And me being who I was at the time, I was a little bit flip, you know? So I said, "I don't know, buy me a steak." And so he looked at me, he said, "Get out of here." And so, you know, I went back to my desk, and so anyway, but I loosened up, and they were starting to take my drawings that I was doing, and they were making model sheets out of my drawings and passing it on to the rest of the staff.
Oh, wow.
Because they were happy with the way I was handling some of the characters.
You just needed to get unbunched.
I had to get art. Yeah. And, you know, I had preconceived ideas of what my job would be or what I should be doing in the studio. And that changed pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, he even said to me, he said, "Yeah, you're green, you know."
Yeah.
"You're green." I said, "Yeah, I'll learn, you know." So, anyway, that was an experience. But anyway,
how long did that position.
Not long. What happened was we worked on the show, and they got all the artwork out for the episodes inside of a couple of months. So I was basically there for the first time for like a month and a half.
Okay.
And then they laid me off. And they said,
my goodness.
And so they said, no, it's not the quality of the work. It's just we're trying to just knock this stuff out quick. And it ended up becoming a very popular show. But I could not get any of the work in Los Angeles at the time. It's still very tough to get work. And so even with that under my belt, you know, a month and a half working for a studio, it wasn't really enough to, like, get me in anywhere.
Sure, yeah.
But I ended up going back to New York.
Okay.
But Ralph didn't forget about me. And so when he actually lived in New York, he would call me up in New York, and I would go up and I would help him, like, on a project here. I actually did a pitch with him at ABC.
Oh, wow.
And
where in New York did he live?
North Salem.
Oh, okay.
North Salem, which is Westchester County, I guess. I think it's like the tip of that, right? But yeah, so he had a schoolhouse. He had an office in a schoolhouse, an old schoolhouse up there. So that was interesting. So he didn't forget about me, and then I ended up doing some other things for him. I had to sort through some artwork for publicity for CBS. So I had all the artwork back here from the show. So I ended up going through it and then picking out some setups, and then we used it as publicity for the show.
Curating that.
Yeah. So that was so I was doing some stuff there, and then finally, you know, they got the pickup for the second season, and that's when I got a place in LA. You know, I got an apartment, and then not living in a hotel. And so I was living in North Hollywood, and the studio had moved from where we were in North Hollywood to now, I believe it was Van Nuys. Mm-hmm. So we were, you know, so I needed a car at that time. So I ended up like renting a car for a couple of weeks until I bought one.
Mm-hmm.
But that was interesting. And when, you know, and that ran out, the show, the episodes ran out too. But when that ran out, I was offered another job at another studio doing something else.
Where was that?
Deke Enterprises. It was a show called Beanie and Cecil. It was a revival of Beanie and Cecil, which was a cartoon back in the early 60s,
mm-hmm.
which was a cartoon based off of a puppet thing that was very popular, that Albert Einstein really liked.
Albert Einstein liked it.
Because it was very...
educational for children?
Or? No, it was very adult in nature.
Oh, okay.
And so that's why Albert Einstein liked it.
So way off.
That's all right. No, Albert Einstein, the puppet thing was on the early 50s, and so very early 50s.
So adult puppets and X-rated.
No. Not adult. It was just a show that appealed to kids, but there were the jokes in it the parents could really like,
mm-hmm.
older people could really appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
And Albert Einstein used to say, like, he'd be in the middle of something, and he said, "Oh, it's 4:15, it's time for Beanie." And he would watch a TV show. So, yeah, that's a thing. So, yeah, I worked on the revival of that. For Deke. Which in the industry, people used to say, "Do it cheap." That was the acronym. But that's not, I'm sure that's not what that meant to them, but that's what it meant to everybody else that was working on shows for them. So I worked on that, and then I ended up starting to work on some animation for other things. So the jobs started coming. People started knowing who I was. And a Disney animator who was working over there at the time, he said, "Ah, you're the hot artist now."
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, and I was like, "What?" He said, "Yeah, you're the hot artist. You're the new guy, the hot artist in town."
The word on the street.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty interesting. That was a new one to me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and then I started meeting all these different people And
is it a small world to work in?
It really is, because at that time, all of a sudden there was a little bit of an explosion. I think the Mighty Mouse show actually helped propel that, but it was there were other projects going on, like Don Bluth got in with Steven Spielberg, and they did a movie called American Tail, which made a lot of money in 1985. Then they did Land Before Time, which also made a lot of money. And then Disney did, A Great Mouse Detective was successful. That was also around 1985. And there seemed to be an upward trajectory, you know, with the animation world. And Spielberg and Zemeckis were working with an animator from London named Richard Williams, and the project was at Disney, and so it utilized Disney artists as well, and it was called Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that was based off of a book, and it was live-action animation, and that took off. That was a big movie when it came out.
It was a huge movie.
So all of a sudden, it was just like all the stuff. One, you know, it was kind of like one thing right after the other. And then all of a sudden, Little Mermaid came out, you know, a couple of years after that, or maybe the same year or the year after. I think it was the year after, I think in 1989.
And there was a resurgence, a huge resurgence.
There was a huge resurgence because then people started going, oh, this stuff can make money. Mm-hmm. And then it was just like it kept going. So Warner Brothers kind of picked up off of that. And I had been working on a lot of freelance stuff in between. I was getting offers to work on a lot of different things. But Don Bluth finally came through. I sent a test to them. I did a test for them. And it was a assistance test. It was pretty much the same test I did maybe, you know,
wow,
8 years before that.
Mm-hmm.
And
8 years before when you had your first job offer for
Don Bluth. Yeah.
How often and how many times thereafter did you circle back to the Don Bluth studios to?
A number of times, but when they had worked on American Tail, they made a decision. It was a business decision. Based off of tax exemptions, and also there was money from Ireland,
uh-huh,
that was being offered. What they would have to do is move the studio from Los Angeles to Ireland, and so they accepted it.
So by moving from LA to Ireland, that would grant them a tax exempt status.
I think Ireland was offering them money to move there.
Wow.
Plus they could utilize the talent in Ireland, train them to work on these movies.
They could
and they would get a tax, some tax advantage for doing that.
Wow.
Yeah. So it just made a lot of sense for them to do that. But they have to uproot, you know, to do that.
Yeah,
so,
that's a lot.
So Don was not, I wasn't sure if I wanted to go to Ireland, you know, and so I didn't even bother applying, you know.
Oh, no.
But there's more to that. What happened was the people that went over there in maybe 85, 86, I guess, they were not happy. Some of their top talents that went over there with them.
And didn't you interview an individual who had gone?
Yes. That was Sandro Clouseau.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so anyway, he went. But my opportunity came when they came back. And it was a lot of the leading talents there. So people like John Pomeroy and Linda Miller and Lorna Pomeroy, and there's a bunch of people that came back from there, and they set up a studio 5 blocks from where I was living. I could walk there.
Wow.
So I heard they were back.
Where was that?
Burbank, California.
In Burbank.
Yeah, okay. It was right across the street from NBC.
Okay.
So, and a couple of blocks away from Warner Brothers. So anyway, I figured, well, this is my opportunity, you know, to get back in there. Mm-hmm. And so they had a nice little studio set up over there. It's like an H-frame building. It's like two stories, a little parking lot in the back. And I knew somebody that had actually gone over there. He was hired over there, and he was like, and he had worked there for a little bit, but he really didn't want to do animation. Yeah, I think he wanted to do more design work. And so he worked there for a little bit, and then he left. But he was saying to me, said, yeah, you know, you should really apply over there. You know, they're looking for people, you know. So I got the number, I called up, and then they said, yeah, you know, we can have you do an assistant test. So I went in, and I just like 9 years earlier, I was just full of needles and pins, you know. And
yeah, like, I'm sure. Yeah. Don't you remember you offered me a job a decade ago?
Yeah, you think they'd just take me, right? So I did the test, and this guy, wonderful guy, John Pomeroy, calls me up the next day, and he says, you know, the test looks great, but we're not really looking for assistance right now. And I went, oh, okay. And he said, but I would like you to take an animator's test. And if that works out, you know, we could probably use you. So animator's test is basically you got to create the whole action.
Wow.
And so, you know, they basically give you two drawings. And so you got to figure out how to get it from point A to point B. But it's not just a straight thing. It's like you got to put physics into it. You got to figure out the timing of it and all that. And so I was like, and I felt very confident. It was weird because that test, I felt I would definitely ace. That's how I felt going in. I was still a little bit nervous about it, but I was like, no, I think I got this, you know? Whereas with the assistance test, I felt I'd be more scrutinized.
Oh.
It should be the other way around, really.
Right.
But anyway, I went in, and they gave me 2 hours to do it. And so I sat there and did a bunch of drawings and flipping the drawings to make sure the action is working the way I want it to work. And so I did it, and I timed it out, and I handed it in 2 hours. And I think I came home and I got a phone call, and I said, your test looks great.
Wow.
You're hired. So we're going
to,
yeah.
The work that you did to do the artwork for this animator's test.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Would you say that the bulk of that was your own, the knowledge that you had garnered?
Yes.
Okay. From your adventures and your self-education and reaching out to other professionals and asking and seeking, yeah, and reading your own books and.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it was I had done animation in school. I'd done animation on my own. I had a setup where I could shoot it onto movie film. And nothing elaborate, but it was just, you know, something on an arm that came up with the camera facing down onto the table.
Did someone tell you to
do that?
Yes.
No.
No.
No, no, but, you know, in books they said this is the way you should do it.
Uh-huh.
You know? And it was all acquired knowledge from books or talking to people. But nobody can teach you how to animate over the phone, you know?
Right.
They can't teach you how to draw over the phone. You have to, that stuff you have to kind of pick up. And a lot of it came through analyzing, like I would get reels of film and analyze a frame by frame.
So
yeah.
So,
yes,
going to SVU.
SVA.
Excuse me, SVA.
Yes.
And, pardon me.
That's all right.
And learning film first.
Right.
Here is another thing where you can circle back because you learned that skill first and that helped enable your animation skills to be cultivated.
They never had us go in and take the film and put it on a moviola and go through it frame by frame.
Uh-huh.
That was something I did on my own.
Interesting.
What they were talking about more was film theory and how shots should work together.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And that aided in helping me when I eventually did storyboarding, because I would do storyboarding for cartoons where it'd be 100 pages of three panels on each page and drawing the whole thing out and making sure that there's continuity from cut to cut to cut. And so that's where they helped me.
Okay.
I took a lot of film classes. We had a gentleman, William K. Everson, who'd written a lot of books on film history. And so he would talk and then he would screen a film. Some of the films were very surprising because I've told the story before. I don't think I've ever told it on the podcast. Maybe I did. But he said, we're going to watch today one of the probably the best special effects film of all time. And this was 1981. So everybody's like, oh. Star Wars.
Right.
We're going to see Star Wars today. You know, everybody's kind of like, oh, wow, this is cool. We're going to see Star Wars.
Everybody loves Star Wars.
And he puts on Darby O'Gill and the Little People. And Darby O'Gill and the Little People is a big special effects movie. It's a great special effects movie because a lot of the effects were done in camera. And if you see it, it's seamless. It's amazing.
That's amazing.
You know, if you haven't seen it, you should watch it.
No, I did when I was very, very small, but Leprechaun, they kind of scare me.
They're just little people. That's all they are. So, but this,
now that you say that, I'm actually intrigued. So I guess I should go back and watch.
Just watch it.
Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Darby O'Gill.
Darby.
Yes. Yeah. So, so that was the, it would be surprising, but. There was films we'd be watching, a lot of silent movies, things where they basically use the technique of, you know, where to place the camera in order to get depth into a shot.
Sure, like Caligari, the cabinet.
Yes. I know what you're talking about. Yes.
Just the way they would position the camera, in the set.
I think
that was enough to scare. I don't even know what the movie is about, but it scared me. So
yeah, it's black and white, silent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That. But the other thing he referenced was a Disney cartoon, because he was like, there's a Disney cartoon referencing that for the depth of the artwork. Because it. You know, he's talking about a Harold Lloyd picture before that, but then he's comparing this Disney cartoon where they're getting all this depth in. I'm like, it's flat artwork,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's the perspective, and, you know, and so I was kind of floored that he wasn't leaving out animation when he was talking about, and it wasn't an animation film thing. It was just film in general.
So you are very well educated, and it's very largely due to your own perseverance and your doggedness and determination.
Yes. I mean, you pick up things everywhere, but you have to be like you really got to be like a sponge.
So how long did you work for Don Bluth?
I worked on... I was working on the tail end of All Dogs Go to Heaven. As it just helping with in-betweening some of the drawings, which is basically, nobody knows what in-betweening is. It's basically, it's 24 frames of drawings in a second, right? And a lot of times these things are working, you know, they're only shooting 12 drawings a second. Because you can shoot a drawing and kind of cheat it to... have it run for like the second frame, then you have the next frame. And it as long as you don't have like any movement going on with the background, nobody will notice it because your eye doesn't see individual drawings. You see the flurry of drawings. So, so I came in on that doing in-betweens, fleshing out the motion of the key drawings. And then, so I did that. And then I was immediately signed to animation on a film called Rockadoodle. And it basically, the story is about a rooster that is like Elvis Presley.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And so anyway, the Jordanaires are on the soundtrack for that movie. And and Glenn Campbell does a great impression of Elvis. He used to do that in his live act. But anyway, so I was animating on that. So I did some scenes on that movie. And then Warner Brothers came calling. I had a friend over at Warner Brothers, and they were, I had already talked to them about working on a show called Tiny Toon Adventures. And it's basically miniature versions of the Looney Tunes.
Right.
So I wasn't making very much money at Don Bluth Studios being an animation trainee. It was not, and I was struggling.
Yeah.
So I was doing a lot of freelance work while I was working there. And I just felt like I'm really busting my butt to just make a decent salary. A friend called up and he said, I worked with him on Mighty Mouse: The New Adventures. His name is Ken Boyer. And he had designed, along with somebody, another gentleman, Alfred Gimeno, they had designed these characters for Tiny Toons. And so they're looking to bring me over to work on the show. So my salary doubled, more than doubled. And so I took the job. And so I left Don Bluth. And so I went over there. And I was there working on the show for about maybe about 6 months. And they called me up from Don Bluth Studios. And they said, look, we're wrapping up work on this movie. We have a much better budget, and we can hire you for this. So they upped my salary. So they brought me back.
Oh.
So I took the job because I was like, well, this was my problem. I wasn't making enough money over there. And so I went back to Don Bluth to animate on the next movie, which was it was actually two different things: A Troll in Central Park. And I was working on a theme park attraction for them, which was the Fantastic World of Hanna-Barbera. And so that was kind of a fun time. But as so I stayed there for a little bit, and then they started running out of money. And all of a sudden, my health insurance wasn't being paid, and there were certain other things where they were late on payments and stuff. And it's expensive to live anywhere, especially today. But back then, it was like I moved up to another apartment. You know, I got like a townhome. So I was like, well, I'm back in the same boat. I'm going to be back in the same boat. They're running out of money. Something's going on. It just seemed like this was my luck. All of a sudden, Warner Brothers called up again. They said, yeah, well, they upped my salary there. And they said, but we want you to come in and do storyboards, which is basically you're planning out the whole cartoon. You're not writing it. You're taking whoever wrote it, and you're just illustrating it and planning your shots and stuff. So I was like, okay. So I left. And it was, and I hate to say it's always about money, but it was basically what that psychic said was basically happening.
Right.
You know, because they more than, I mean, my salary like quadrupled.
Wow.
Then I found myself like just getting raises. I was like, I'm not asking for them. They're just giving me the raises. So I stayed with Warner Bros. I worked on, finished up the Tiny Toon Adventures as a storyboard artist. They loved everything I was doing. And then we moved on to Animaniacs. And so that was good. And while I was there, I was I guess I liked the money, so I just kept freelancing on different projects. So one of the projects I freelanced on was Pink Panther. So I did a couple of episodes of that. And I did some things for Disney, and yeah, so it was a little crazy, but it was all good, you know. And everybody liked what I was doing, so just, you know, I was cool with that.
So you feel you really made your mark when you worked for Warner Brothers? You really made your name.
I think what I realized was I had a really good story. I had a really good story sense. Mm-hmm. And what I learned really quickly was there's a lot of good animation talent in the business. At that time, there was a lot of good animation talent. And I felt like I was good, but I felt like one of the weak things that we had at Don Bluth Studios was the fact that our stories weren't that great. There was not a whole lot of humor in these stories either. And so before I left, they realized this was a picture called The Troll in Central Park. And, you know, I'd been vocal about a lot of things. I mean, I thought I was going to get fired at one point for being so vocal, because I just thought The Troll in Central Park, I just thought there was a section in there that was just absolutely ridiculous.
What section was that?
They called it the Pansy Dance.
Sounds ridiculous.
that's kind of a clue, but the character of the troll is with these kids, and all of a sudden he makes these flowers come to life, and they start doing this horrible dance. And it was so ridiculous that at the screening for it, I was actually giggling. It was so bad. And so after the screening, I was very vocal about it to other people, which I probably should not have been. But I really wanted the studio to
wanted it to be a success.
Yeah, I wanted it to be a success. I wanted to be proud of it. And and I just felt like, wow, you know, you're really dumbing this down to, like, you know, 2-year-olds.
Yeah.
Because that's 2 or 3-year-olds are the only ones that are going to like this. You know, parents are going to be rolling their eyes.
Yeah.
You know, going out to the lobby and smoking cigarettes. Yeah. Even if they didn't smoke, you know. So, no, that was my feeling on it. And so I would just tell other people, they're killing the studio. They're killing the studio. And I said, this is probably one of the worst sequences of any animated movie, right. Period.
Sure.
So word got around, and the head of the studio of that particular studio, Don Bluth Hollywood, he called me into his office. I was like, oh, God, here we go. You know, and I had to make a decision. I could lie through my teeth, or I could be absolutely honest with him. And I was like, well, the jig's up. He already knows how I feel about it. So sure. I might as well just be honest. And if they kick me out, they kick me out, and that's it. You know, so be it.
Well, integrity means you're not always going to be prom king, the most popular guy in the room.
So I sat down there, and I was pretty much, he said to me first, he said, I heard you didn't like the movie. And I said, no, I didn't.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, his arms fold, you know, and he leans back in his chair, you know, I'm doing that now.
Right. It's
like fading out. But very serious expression came across his face, and I'm like, all right, well, I better temper this with some, you know, love, you know. So I'm like, look, don't get me wrong. You know, I love this studio. I love the work we're doing. I think we got some amazing, I think there's amazing talent here. But I said, I really feel like you're killing the studio. I said, not you personally, but I feel like whatever they're doing with these stories, you're killing it. You can't play to 3-year-olds. You have to play higher. And I said, I was laughing. I was giggling, not to be obnoxious. I couldn't hold it in. It was so bad.
It was just
so bad.
Too ridiculous.
Too ridiculous. And so I said, I want the studio to make great things. I want the studio to succeed. And I said, this is not the way to succeed.
Right. And how did they take that?
Then he unfolded his arms.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay.
Yeah, because what matters is the intention.
Yeah. So he looked at me and he said, so why don't you say something about that? I said, I'm telling you now. And he said, well, I think he was a little bit frustrated with it too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, everything kind of changed, you know? And it was like, well, you know, you should put your thoughts in a letter. And I think we should get that to Don and have him look at it. Because I think you're making some good points. And so...
It's so important to listen. It doesn't matter if you're the CEO of whatever. It's so important to listen. You learn so much more. You improve. One improves so much more.
Right.
When they listen.
Yeah. So anyway, I did that. I put together, I think it was a 3 or 4 page letter. I stayed late to do it. I actually used their typewriter to do it. You know, there was no word processor at the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I typed up this thing, and I never heard anything about it after that.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe not shortly, but after that, they came back with a sequence that they were having problems with, and they said, this really has to have some humor to it. And, you know, we're charged with trying to fill it up with some gags and stuff. So they said, want everybody to kind of go back to their desks and to, you know, to think about it. And then we'll have a meeting and we'll talk about all the ideas. I felt that was an opportunity for me. Because I went through the storyboard that we had. I went through the script. And so I came up with a bunch of ideas. And so I was kind of telling some people around. I said, you know, I'm thinking about this, we should do this and we should do this and do this. And so came up with all these different ideas. So when we got together, what was happening at this meeting was somebody said something, they had an idea and then I said an idea and they liked it. And then somebody chimed in, yeah, Brian has this other idea about this that I think is really good. And it's one of the directing animators. And so it kind of became like, all of a sudden, it was just all my ideas were getting chucked in. So they used a lot of it. And I think that was probably the point for me when I realized, you know, I'm more valuable as an idea guy, as story guy, than I am as an animator.
Got it.
And because we can get the people to animate it, but if you don't have the story there, if you don't have those ideas there, then basically you're kind of dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're dead in the water.
Animate,
yeah. So I think that's when I realized that this is where I'm valuable. And so after that, I ended up going into storyboarding.
For Warner Brothers
and yeah. For a lot of other companies, I ended up storyboarding. So MGM for Pink Panther, ended up working for Universal and Casper. I was doing stories for them, you know, the storyboards for them and injecting gags in and stuff like that. And even at Disney, there was a show called The Schnookums and Meat Funny Cartoon Show. And they gave me a script to storyboard for them, which I did, but the ending didn't work for me, and I was like, this is not resolved. It was something about Schnookums and Meat. It was a cat and dog character, which are always battling each other, and they're just so bad that they die, and they go to hell.
Oh my heavens!
And so. So the end of the cartoon, they had them, they do go to hell. They do die and they go to hell. And the ending was just very flat. They go to hell and then it's these two beautiful girls.
But they're hooking up.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're hooking up. So anyway, I said, what it should really be is these two really ugly women. And it's like they pull off the like a mask or whatever, and this is what they're stuck with, like really, you know, goofy, ugly women. So, and then it's basically, no, we really, you know, and so they scream at the end. And so I pitched that to the producer at the time, producer director, which was Bill Kopp. And he looked at it and he said, that's funny. And yeah, do that. And so that's the ending of the cartoon.
It's so much better than just, yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of, it was very plain. It just seemed, it seemed to me like, you know, the natural ending for the cartoon should be that, you know. So that was basically it.
So after Warner Brothers, what's the journey now?
What is the journey now?
Yeah.
After Warner Brothers, I worked on The Spooktacular Adventures of Casper, which was a lot of fun to work on. It was very loose. I was able to do these things the way I wanted to. I made them very goofy, you know. I worked on the Dumb and Dumber revival. Or not a revival. It was an animated version of it. So that was on ABC.
You got your Emmy.
The Emmy was from Animaniacs. Yeah. So I was living in California, and then after the Northridge quake, moved back to New York. And I always wondered if that was a good move or not. But when I moved back to New York, there were a lot of opportunities that were offered to me. And some things didn't go quite too well, but then all of a sudden everything started clicking in. And that's a long story that I'm not going to talk about. But all of a sudden things were being offered to me. And what was nice was I was working for Universal. Was it Universal? No, I was working on two different shows. So I was working on Dumb and Dumber and Casper.
You've always loved Casper.
I loved Casper when I was a little kid. And I kind of grew out of it. But what was interesting was it's always held some sort of affection in my heart, you know. So when it was offered, it was at a time when I just, you know, I needed the work, you know.
Everybody loves Casper.
Yeah. But I was very happy to have that because it was a fun show to work on. And it lasted for maybe three years. Yeah, I did maybe three or four years worth of work on that. And so it was nice, yeah. So it was for the long haul. And then I got stuff to animate and did commercials. I taught animation.
And you taught at Disney.
I did. Disney later called me and they wanted me to come to Florida. They had an animation event that they were doing. And they, and it wasn't out of the kindness of their heart. They were charging a fortune for it. But anybody wanted to come down and participate and make do a little piece of animation, they would have instructors there. And so I was called and offered to instruct and as well as that, also do some lectures. And so I accepted that. And it was just a week. But it was a lot of fun. I didn't think I was going to have a lot of fun doing it, but I had a lot of fun doing it.
That's
fun. Met a gentleman named Jim Corcus, who just passed away not too long ago. He's a Disney historian, but he was involved with that. And I had a really fun week. We were just talking about stuff. Absolute expert on everything Disney, and he's on in every book.
Well, you love animation and you love history.
And so I love Disney. Sure. Yeah. So it was a lot of fun doing that. And they called me back for the next year and the year after that. So I did it for 3 years straight. So that was nice. And worked with Christopher Reeve on Everyone's Hero, once again, doing story work. But that was pulled out from Chris died while they were making it.
Yeah.
and the production was pulled to California. And so everybody who was working here in New York on it, they were basically, nobody was retained. Everybody was kind of let go. Mm-hmm. So I'd worked on some other projects. I worked on some Tom and Jerry stuff. And,
speaking of everyone's hero, yeah. Have you ever had the pleasure of working with one of your own heroes?
I worked with a lot of them, and I met a lot of them. And so there was a gentleman.
What was the best part of working for people whom you, coming up, considered to be a hero?
Working for, I ended up working with a lot of those people.
Right.
There was, years ago, there was these Roadrunner cartoons that Warner Brothers did back in the 1950s, late 40s, 50s. And I would see this guy's name on these cartoons all the time. His name was Tom Ray. Tom Ray. So his daughter was working at Warner Brothers when I was there. So she was doing timing. They call sheet timing. But Tom was there, and he was also doing sheet timing. And what sheet timing is they time out the storyboards for the animators. So each action gets timed out. And, mm-hmm. and so that's what he was doing. But he had animated on all those cartoons, you know, the Roadrunners, Bugs Bunnies. And so, you know, I go in and introduce myself. He was actually working on our unit. So, you know, I didn't really directly work with him, even though he was working in the same unit. But the thing about Tom Ray was I would go in and I would talk to him, you know, and he had every morning he had muffins. He had these bran muffins that he'd bring in. And so I'd swipe one while talking to him. Very wonderful guy. I mean, and when I moved back to New York here, he would keep in contact. I would get a phone call from Tom from time to time. He's now passed on, but he was actually living here on the East Coast. He moved to the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted me to work with him on some stuff. And it never happened, but, you know, but he would call me. So it was pretty neat, you know.
So would you say it was like the best part of working with your heroes? Because I've never worked with a hero of my own.
Right.
But would you say it's the learning from them or the camaraderie or the shared experiences or
it might be all of the above, yeah. But I think it's just to me, I always respected those people that worked on that stuff. And so when I was working right, you know, when you're growing up and you see something, you see somebody that you know, like a singer that you might really like, and then you get a chance to meet them. It's kind of an electric moment, right? Because it's part of your childhood and stuff like that. So working with a guy like Tom Ray, or we had another guy, Charlie Downs, that was there, and a number of different people. I mean, I can't even go through all the names, but this is somebody that you were very impressed by. You'd see the name all the time and you knew they were doing this stuff. And now you're working side by side with them. I guess there's a couple of things at play. It's the fact that you're good enough now to be working side by side with them.
Amongst greatness.
Right.
Yeah.
But now it's like, you know, now you're going out to lunch with them, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's pretty amazing to me.
So would you say, you know, because mm-hmm. we've talked a great deal about the struggles and the speed bumps and the moments of discouragement, and was
it worth it?
Was that the reward?
I guess yes.
Okay.
I think there's a lot of rewards. I think there's, when you work on a cartoon and whatever you're doing on it, whether you're designing it or you're doing the story work on it, or, you know, when you see that cartoon, you know that's working, you know it's entertaining, and you know that other people are enjoying it. then that, there's a satisfaction of that. There's a satisfaction of seeing your work up on the screen and you've on a big movie screen, something that you've animated and you struggled with, but now it's up there and now it's part of this movie. There are these two animators, Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston, that there's a movie about them, Frank and Ollie. And I know you've tried to watch it, but
I did watch it.
You did.
I saw some.
Yes. I love the movie, but there's a moment in there where they say, you know, Frank talks about working on Pinocchio and working on this scene and it's like yours, you know, you're crafting it and you're doing all the drawings and you're finessing it. And then now you're watching it on the screen and now it's in color, but it's your work. It's your animation up there. And now it's not, you worked on it and stuff like that, but now it's part of a bigger thing. It's part of this entire movie and it kind of takes on its own life, you know? Because now this character is a bigger thing, and so it's you have pride for working on it, but now it's not yours anymore. It's part of this bigger thing. So
there's
a satisfaction.
Yeah, yeah, a great satisfaction.
Yeah,
they breathed the life into it.
They put the life into it, and yeah. So that so even for a TV screen, for you know something I worked on Animaniacs, which didn't seem like a big thing to me. It's something called Yakko's World, and it's basically, they call it Nations of the World. And it's a 3-minute piece, and it's Yakko Warner, and he's pointing to all the nations of the world, to the Mexican hat dance. But it's United States, Panama, Mexico, Panama, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know. I can't think of it. I can't sing it. But anyway, the point is that I stressed over doing that because there wasn't a whole lot going on other than him pointing at countries. And so I had to kind of invent things and actions to make it kind of entertaining. Because the thing that I always loved about Disney films, and you know, you watch Peter Pan, it's every scene has something in it to
kind of make
you laugh.
What did you call it? Bits and pieces?
Business. Bits and pieces business.
Oh, bits of business.
Yes. So so the whole idea, it's keeping you entertained while telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
So it could just be some little thing where the character blows hair up, you know, kind of puts the lip out and blows the hair up. You know, which, you know, it maybe not funny, but interesting. You know, every scene has something interesting in it. So this was my task for doing this short, this 3-minute thing. It's like, and the script just said, have him pointing at countries, you know. And so I invented this whole thing where it's like, well, he can point to countries, but why don't we have him, like, changing hats?
Mm-hmm.
It could be the hat of Mexico or the hat of, you know, Denmark or whatever. So that was the way I approached it because I wanted to keep it entertaining. I was trying – but ultimately they wanted an educational piece, and they just wanted the character pointing at countries. So I had to kind of invent or use – other things that would work into this 3-minute piece. And so one of the things I called for was having, when he's pointing to the country, to have it light up. We could just have him point to the countries, but I was like, no, we should have the country light up. But I added a little dance at the beginning, which I didn't create, but we had it. Somebody had done this little dance with this character.
Mm-hmm.
So we should use that and put it in here. So I called for that and then did a bunch of other things within it to kind of keep it interesting. And then had the finale where it's basically the map rolls up and the character rolls up into the map. So that was so trying to keep it inventive. But anyway, this thing came out. And I remember the director of it, basically timed it, but I did all the visuals on it and all the gags and stuff. So he one day comes into my cubicle and he said, I want you to see something. And so we go up to editing and they're showing me this short that we put together. And it was so good. I'm watching it with the soundtrack and all that on a little screen, maybe, 6 inches across. And but watching it, and I was like, wow, the overseas studio that animated it followed everything. And they basically used all my drawings. And so because that's how tight it was with the map, it had to be. But anyway, this thing was, it came out really well, better than I ever thought it would. And so Warner Brothers saw it, the heads of the studio saw it, Warner Brothers, and immediately they started running it in the Warner Brothers stores before the show came on the air.
Uh-huh.
They used it as the plug for the show.
Oh, wow.
And so this piece ended up being in the Warner Brothers store. They ran it on, I think it was Fox at the time had Animaniacs.
Uh-huh.
So they were running it months before, weeks before the show actually came on. It was basically the teaser for the show.
Wow.
And it ended up being shown in the show, of course. But
it was your creation.
Well, I didn't create the idea for it. It was just they wanted something that was educational, even though it's not quite educational because there's a lot of cheats with the countries because they need stuff to rhyme. And so that was something that, and to this day, that short subject is now being run on this Animaniacs concert tour.
It's like the moniker for, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the concert tour, and they have the guy who did the voice for the character doing it live.
Oh, that is
so funny. And I think they changed it a little bit, but it's still the same animation up there. So
makes you feel very good.
It makes me feel good because it's something that is, it was done back in the early 90s. So it's 30 years. But nothing lasts 30 years. You know, any show that lasts, very few, So Seinfeld is last, Friends is lasted. But I can't think of any other animated show that has really had the longevity.
When we visited you invited me to go to the Museum of the Moving Image.
Yes.
And we're just walking around on a lazy, cold Sunday afternoon.
Right. It's a wonderful museum, though. Right?
Fans are popping out of the woodworks.
Yeah.
Taking selfies with you over this Animaniacs.
Yeah.
I think I want to see that scene.
I have to show it to you. Yeah.
We should watch that after.
Yeah. Well,
maybe you'll play that for me.
Yeah, I'll play it for you.
So where... what next? Where are we going to go?
Well, we started up Cartoonerific, and the whole idea is basically, we're doing the podcast, of course, but the whole idea is to do new animated shorts, new shows and stuff like that. We're not quite there yet. It's a little bit of a process.
But I love animated shorts.
Yeah, they're fun, right? Just watch something. I showed this to you.
Yes, that was the fun. Talk about bits of business.
Yes, the Brave Locomotive, I think that's what it was. And so it's a Disney artist that did it. It's quite good. And if you follow us on Facebook, I put some links to it. It's really a wonderful short. And it looks like something the Disney studio did in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But it was done by this guy, and I can't think of his name, and I'll say that later. But it's an amazing short that was done with private money. It wasn't done with a short like that to be done at Disney cost about $1 million.
It had so much in it. Yeah, at least. Had so much going on in it.
Yeah.
And there were a couple other short animated pieces that you've shown me on Disney that I get so much pleasure out of.
Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff out there. And, yeah. You know, and they're not... So, you know, eventually what I want to do with Cartoonerific is to do a bunch of shorts and put them on like a YouTube. We have a YouTube channel. It's not fully developed yet, but we're working on it. And so these shorts will end up, and they're not going to be Disney style. I would say they'd probably be more Warner Brothers style, you know, funny. But eventually we'd like to get there to do some shorts, kind of like that short we're talking about, The Brave Locomotive. You know, eventually I hope everybody loves it.
I look forward to it.
Yeah.
I really, really look forward to it. I look forward to all of our stuff. All of our Cartoonerific.
Yes.
Meetings.
Yeah. So there you go. So anyway, so that's the future. And I keep mentioning this book that I'm writing, which is very interesting. It's talking about all these things that happen in life. And I don't know when this is going to come out, but it's halfway written, but it's still, you know, it still needs some fine tuning. But it's going to be about all my life experiences and all these things, these synchronicities that we're talking about.
Meant to be's, kind of.
Yeah, I've talked to people about this, and, you know, I'm a firm believer that there's no such thing as a coincidence. I think it's an easy word. It's a cheap word, a coincidence, because it just means that, well, it just happened at the same time, right?
It is a bit of a throwaway. it kind of takes a lot for granted. It discounts a lot.
No, I don't believe in coincidences. I think that things happen for a reason. I've always felt that. Like when you're born, I think there is some sort of a life path that's already kind of set for you. Like you're supposed to be going in this direction. And it kind of brings us back to the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. I was just always interested in entertainment. I love comedy. Excuse me. I love mystery. I love film. And I love video. Mm-hmm. And I love music. Animation is perfect for me because mm-hmm. it's a combination of those drawing talents. What I found very funny, I guess we're wrapping up, right?
If you want to.
Yeah. Well, we can't have this go on for 2 days. I think what's really interesting is... It's almost like, you know, my life was really meant for this medium. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a few years there where I got away from it. But I'm coming back to it because I love it. And I just feel like it's
meant to be. That's
what I'm supposed to be doing. Yeah. So there you go.
No coincidences.
There you go.
Meant to be.
Yes. So
I really enjoy talking to you.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And when I ever have a podcast again, I'll call you and we'll do a. Oh yes, I have a podcast.
I'm sorry. Yes, you do. Yeah. I will gladly relinquish the seat to you.
All right.
Our lovely host and temporary guest.
Oh, you're a wonderful host. Thank you so much. You did great.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions or comments about the podcast? Please email Brian at Cartoonerific.com. Your email may be featured in one of our future shows.
Hey, wasn't that wonderful? Brian Mitchell came on here and he spilled his guts. How do you like that? Anyway, thank you, Marjorie Stewart, the lovely Marjorie Stewart. She did such a wonderful job, and she's always been a special guest on this show, and we'll likely have her back in the future. Very, 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 very likely. Well, in the weeks ahead on the Cartoonerific podcast, we have a bunch of special guests coming on. Next week, it's going to be Didier Gez. Didier has, he's an author, and he's a Disney historian. He's written a bunch of books about animation and about the various artists that worked in it. And so we're going to have him on. So that should be a fun interview. Also coming up is Miss Cynthia Petrovic. Cynthia has worked on a lot of your favorite TV shows, and she has a lot of special humor and wit, and that should be a fun, fun interview. So that's coming up in weeks ahead. We're also going to do a Christmas countdown of the top Christmas holiday specials. So we'll be doing that probably close to Christmas. Anyway, if you really like what you're listening to, please subscribe. Go to your favorite service and click that button, and you'll be notified every time a Cartoonerific podcast is uploaded for your listening pleasure. Also, please, please, please tell a friend about us. Anyway, I want everybody to have a great day. I want you to have an excellent week, and thank you once again for tuning in.
This has been a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
The Cartoonerific podcast is copyright 2024 by Cartoonerific Studios Incorporated. All rights reserved.